Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Art and Faith. A Vatican press conference unveils details of Pope Benedict's forthcoming meeting with artists in the Sistine Chapel. Progress in Catholic-Orthodox relations. Cardinal Walter Kasper talks about a recent meeting in Cyprus and the current challenges to theological dialogue with the Orthodox world. And a possible papal visit to the UK. The Secretary of State for Scotland holds talks with top Vatican officials and shares his hopes with Vatican Radio. A press conference took place on Thursday here in the Vatican, unveiling details of Pope Benedict's forthcoming meeting in the Sistine Chapel with contemporary artists from around the world. My colleague Veronica Scaresbrick went along to find out more and spoke to an official at the Pontifical Council for Culture, Richard Rouse.
Contemporary artists in that cenacle of artists, the Sistine Chapel, on the 21st of November, as Pope Benedict XVI meets with artists from across the world, Catholics and non-Catholics alike, to mark two anniversaries, that of 10 years since the letter of Pope John Paul II to artists in 1999, in which he encouraged a fruitful alliance between art and faith, highlighting how artistic intuition goes beyond what the senses perceive, how believers know they have a momentary glimpse of light, which has its original wellspring in God. And that of that historic meeting in the Sistine Chapel 45 years ago, it was May 1964, of Pope Paul VI with artists. An occasion in which he rapped artists over the knuckles for having forgotten about that prolific love affair between church and art for almost two centuries. A period in which they lowered their standards to the extent of confusion, a Tower of Babel of sorts. Admitting all the while to the church's responsibility and failure to foster art, which he attributed to a clash between artists' boundless creativity and the church's imposition of styles and limiting rules and regulations in the field of art. So Pope Benedict XVI has quite an act to follow. I asked Richard Rouse, an official at the Pontifical Council for Culture, to tell me what the purpose of this meeting is.
The purpose of the meeting is to sow the seeds of beauty and meaning in the dialogue between artists and the church.
Can I ask you, who are the artists attending?
We're expecting to have around about 260 artists attending. They're representatives of different categories of art. So we would have representatives of the visual arts, the sculptors, the painters, those who do installations. We have representatives of the world of architecture, representatives of literature and poetry. We have a category of music, so singers and composers. Musicians who play instruments from the organ to the violin, the flute. And then finally, the last category is that of cinema and other visual movement arts, extending as far as the theatre, film directors, actors and actresses as well.
Can you point to famous names in the English-speaking world anyway?
Yeah, we have Bill Viola, Amy Stewart, Bob Wilson, Peter Greenaway, Martin Baker from England as well.
I believe this is the first in a series of initiatives that the Pontifical Council for Culture wishes to sponsor, no?
Yes, that's right. It's almost an opening of a series of events. In this occasion, what's really exciting is we're going to listen to the Holy Father's words. We're going to understand what Benedict wants and what he wants to listen to and to talk about in as far as his relationship with the contemporary world of art and artists goes. So it's going to be a listening occasion. We're going to listen to Benedict and understand where he goes with contemporary art, as we did with Paul VI and John Paul II through those events that you mentioned before. Thereafter, yes, there's going to be a series of events at national, international, continental levels, with the moral and sponsorship of the Pontifical Council for Culture and other organisms of the church. Here in Italy, that everyone's talking about the Padiglione at Venice, the Biennale, there's a famous festival they have every 2 years. 1 year is on architecture, and the following year it's always dedicated to contemporary art. And we're going to have a Padiglione, that's a little pavilion, a Holy See pavilion, on contemporary art.
Michelangelo always said that when carving the Pietà, he was releasing its spirit from the marble. No doubt the meeting of artists with Pope Benedict XVI in the Sistine Chapel on the 21st of November will inspire them to release more of this great spirit and allow them to have that momentary glimpse of that abyss of light Pope John Paul II spoke about in his letter to artists in 1999.
My thanks to Veronica Scaresbrick there for that report on Pope Benedict's forthcoming meeting with artists in the Sistine Chapel. Catholic and Orthodox leaders met in Cyprus in October to discuss the issue of papal primacy during the first millennium, that is, before the Great Schism between the East and Western churches of 1054. The week-long plenary session of the Joint International Commission for Theological Dialogue between the Catholic and Orthodox churches concluded with a communique saying small steps have been made towards agreement on the role of the Bishop of Rome, an issue which remains a major stumbling block on the road towards reconciliation between East and West. Chairing the meeting for the Catholic side was the president of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Casper. On his return to Rome, I asked the Cardinal if this plenary session has raised any hopes of a breakthrough in Catholic-Orthodox relations in the foreseeable future.
I do not think we did not make a breakthrough in Cyprus, but first of all, I should say, and that's also a breakthrough, we had a very warm reception from the Church of Cyprus, from the Bishop Nicosia, Archbishop Nicosia, Archbishop of Paphos, and there was a very good relations also among Catholic and Orthodox members of the Commission. So it is a very emotional question, primacy for the Orthodox. The discussion remained very serene, and so all the manifestations, especially in Greece in the last weeks and also in Cyprus, the Orthodox members remained very determined to continue the dialogue and to go on. And I think that's already a very important thing in the last years. Often when it comes to papacy, there were very strong emotions in the room. This was not the case this time. But then when we came to the issue itself, of course, there are a lot of problems and there are different views about the first millennium, and we had to discuss every text we normally quote in favor of a certain kind of primacy of the Bishop of Rome had to be discussed at length. But it was a consensus that there is something as a primacy. And it's not only a primacy of honor, honor understood in an honorific sense. There is a reality behind, but up to now we were not able to define what was this reality in the first millennium. It's also difficult, first millennium is long. There are a lot of developments in the first millenniums and different signs and different witnesses. So we have to go on in Vienna next year.
So a very cordial atmosphere all the same inside the sessions. We saw the demonstrators being arrested outside. You're saying that didn't really cast a shadow over the meeting, though?
Now, these demonstrators were called also by the Orthodox as a balanced person, fanatics, which exist everywhere. They had these banners with stupid things. Yes. Well, you could not discuss with such kind of people. Well, and we did avoid every conflict with them, because it does not make sense. And then they locked them in the church nearby, and then the police had to pull them out. But that's an inner Orthodox and a question and a state question with the police. It did not so much impress us. It was embarrassing for the hosts, of course. But I told them I was so long time in the university. After 68, I am accustomed to such kind of manifestations. And today in our pluralistic society, you cannot make any event without some protesters. We get accustomed to it.
Of course, Pope Benedict will be visiting Cyprus in 2010. Is this likely to be a difficult issue for the organisers of that visit as well?
I do not think so. It will be a very warm welcome for the Holy Father. They are very proud that he comes to Cyprus, and this will be very well organized, and I think the police will take care of him. There will not be any problem. No, on the contrary, it will be a good visit, and it's an apostolic visit, because in Cyprus there were three apostles, Paul, Barnabas, and Mark, and they are very saints through the ages, so it will be a good, and it's considered as a part of the Holy Land. And so there is no danger for the Pope, and there will be very good welcome.
My thanks there to Cardinal Walter Kasper, President of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. Meanwhile, the British government Secretary of State for Scotland, Jim Murphy, was here in Rome at the end of October meeting with top Vatican officials ahead of a possible visit to the UK by Pope Benedict next autumn. While there has been no official confirmation from the Vatican, reports have been circulating recently that the Pope has accepted an invitation to travel to England, possibly for the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman. Following on from Pope John Paul II's visit in 1982, Pope Benedict would thus become only the second pontiff to visit Britain since the Church of England broke from Rome almost 500 years ago. If the trip does go ahead, then Jim Murphy would most likely be the British government's man charged with the huge task of coordinating the visit, hence his talks with top officials here in the Vatican. I caught up with him briefly to find out a bit more, and although he couldn't confirm the speculations surrounding this visit, he did tell me about a growing sense of expectation in England and the kind of welcome the Pope would find if he should travel north of the border to Scotland as well. Jim Murphy, welcome to our studios here at Vatican Radio.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're visiting the Vatican, I know, to discuss the possibility of Pope Benedict's trip to Scotland next autumn. Yeah. Can you confirm, first of all, that he is coming, and tell us anything about the arrangements so far, the preparations that are going on?
Well, it would be fantastic if the Holy Father was to come to Scotland and as part of a visit to the United Kingdom. Ultimately, that's something for the Vatican to confirm dates or things like that. But I'm here to discuss the possible visit to Scotland and the visit to the entire United Kingdom. And I'm certain that the Pope would receive a fantastic welcome in Britain, but a very special Scottish welcome if he was to travel north of the border. But my message very clear to the Vatican is that we would love to see the Pope in Scotland. We'd love to see him in Britain. It would be a historic moment with a fantastic cause of celebration for people of all faiths throughout Britain. And the British government's taking it very seriously indeed. I've spoken to the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary about it, both of whom are really very enthusiastic about the prospect of any visit. If the Vatican confirmed it was happening, then we would be absolutely delighted and would make every effort to make it a visit to remember.
Tell us something about the Catholic Church in Scotland today.
Well, the Catholic Church in Scotland is a really important institution in the country. I think Scotland's probably the most Catholic part of Britain, with up to, figures suggesting up to 20% of the population being Catholic faith. It's a faith that's benefited over the years from waves of immigration from Ireland. Many of my own family came from Ireland. As a Murphy, that's kind of pretty obvious point. But and more recently, there's been an influx of Central and Eastern European migrants as part of the great expansion of the European project, with 27 democracies working together. So very many Polish families have come to Scotland and brought a real sense of hard work, but also faith and a sense of family with them. So it's a really energetic church. It's a very important church led by Cardinal O'Brien. But I think it's an organisation, an institution that can never be ignored, should never be ignored and isn't ignored. But probably more importantly, it's hundreds of thousands of Scots, of good people, who build Scotland and make it the success that it is, along with others, of course, of other faiths.
In the past, there has been quite a history of sectarian violence between the Church of Scotland. I'm wondering, what are relations like today? How would you characterise relations with the Kirk today?
I think the relationship between different faith groups in Scotland has never been better. It's fantastically strong and a real cause for reflection on just how far things have improved in quite a short period of time. The relationship between the Catholic Church, the Church of Scotland and other faiths is a really very strong one. And look, as a politician, as a government minister, you more often have all the faith organisations coming together to gang up in the government than to criticise one another. It's something that I'm very proud of, is the fact that the Church of Scotland, the Catholic Church and other faiths, the small Jewish community and the small Muslim community and others, just have excellent relations.
What kind of voice do these faith communities have in the running of the country today, do you think, from your own perspective? Yeah.
Well, of course, we have an established church in the Church of England, with the monarch, Queen Elizabeth, as the head of the church. So faith is an important part of our unwritten constitution. But it's also the fact that with the Church of England being the established church, there's still an enormous room and opportunity for the Catholic Church and other faith groups to have a big influence on government policy. Now, it's important that we get the distinction right between church and state, but I think the church is the Catholic Church and others are increasingly articulate, increasingly confident and increasingly influential organisation throughout the UK. I think that Britain is a better place because of the Catholic Church, and Scotland's a better place because of the role of the Catholic Church. I think our country is a better place because of the role of faith more generally. And I worry that if the kind of creeping secularisation, to the exclusion of faith, that is commonplace in some intellectual circles, I think it would rob our country of something which is very important and would make us intellectually weaker and less solid as a society.
You're certainly right that the figures show secularism to be on the increase. In fact, more people, I think, in the last census declared themselves to be of no religion than of the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what efforts are being made, perhaps, to counteract this.
I'm one of those politicians who, and I've reflected on this before, is that in Britain you don't shout about your faith. It's just, but I'm always happy to talk about my faith. But it's really not, the government can't create a solution to dwindling numbers in some churches and across different faith groups. But I think that if you look at all the big challenges today, whether it's climate change or global poverty or the effects of the global recession, government can't solve these things by itself. And the leadership and the moral direction and the moral sense of right and wrong and personal responsibility that faith brings is unquestionably part of the solution to all these big problems. So I think that the Vatican and the Catholic Church as an organisation has remarkable reach. It has influence that governments can only envy on occasion in some very delicate and difficult places. So I think that the Church, in some of these big issues, is more relevant than ever before. So I think it's about how do you display and prove that relevance, and I think that's the big challenge for the Church. And also, in a world where people claim to be busier than ever before, in a world where materialism has been elevated to the status of a kind of quasi-theology, the kind of must-have-it-now celebration of financial success and reward. And the consequence, of course, has been the collapse of the banks internationally, of that kind of ethos and loss of morality. Then I think right now is a really very important time for the church, and I think it can show a kind of increased relevance and real durability to help the world get through the problems that we now face. And I think that's part of the solution. Unprecedented relevance.
You're talking about the economic recession, and at the beginning of the year, in fact, Glasgow was reported as suffering from the worst economic crisis in the history of the city. Can you tell us what impact this has had and whether there are, in fact, now any hopes of coming through that, any kind of recovery?
Yeah, I saw that report, and these reports come and go, and that one was particularly bleak, but there have been others that have been much more optimistic. Glasgow is a fantastic city. I encourage all your listeners to come and visit. But it's a city that's a phenomenal history. It was the second city of the British Empire, and it's a city that's seen tough times, and it's a city and a people that have never given up on themselves and never will do. In the Victorian era, it was considered to be the poorest city in Europe, the most difficult, overcrowded city in Europe, but it's come such a long way. Glasgow's considered itself as the dear green place, more parks and more green spaces than any other city in Europe, and it's come so far. But of course, the global recession has had its impact in Glasgow, as it had in every city. There's no country and no city in the world that's unaffected by the recession. But reports of Glasgow's demise are greatly exaggerated. It's a city with a real confidence about itself. But don't take my word for it. Even though I'm in Vatican Radio, come and see for yourself.
You mentioned a couple of other areas in which you've been taking a lead, issues of international concern, global warming, for example, and, of course, we're looking ahead to this big Copenhagen conference. Mm-hmm. What is the government, and particularly up in Scotland, what are you doing to try and raise concern about this, to get people to really take part in this campaign, to push governments to do something now?
Well, the British government, our view is that time is running out. We can't continue to pollute our environment. And this isn't just about the future. It isn't about future generations. It's about here and now. Even today, we see the effects of climate change and unpredictable weather, unsustainable peaks and troughs in weather conditions. And the problem that's perhaps less so in Rome or in London or Glasgow or Washington, but in some of the poorest countries in the world, this problem's created by the richest countries. It's us that polluted the world. It's our behaviour and our, if you like, short-term selfishness, which has caused this problem. But, well, the richest countries caused it. The poorest countries are most affected by it. They're worst affected and they're first affected, with millions of people threatened to become refugees as a consequence of climate change. And we'll all feel the consequences of that, because these refugees will look to come to Europe and other countries. So we can't take the continued changes in the planet's temperature, with the sea heating faster than the land, and higher the latitudes, the higher the increase in temperatures. And the UK government's very clear that we cannot go beyond a two degrees increase in temperatures. And we're determined to get a deal at Copenhagen, and we're trying to persuade every other government in the world to do so. It's not easy, but we're going to keep trying. And again, I think the Vatican has a big role to play here. The leadership, the moral leadership, the sense of responsibility, and the way in which the Vatican argues about looking after God's creation, I think is a very important contribution and very influential.
You're talking also about the effect that this will have on developing countries. Another area of key concern is this issue of overseas aid, the money that, particularly in these times of recession, is constantly under threat, this budget being cut. What are your views on that? Do you think there is a chance that this will, in fact, be able to be maintained at current levels? Certainly, I know in Ireland at the moment, I think they're cutting the budget.
I think we have to maintain our commitment to the poorest people in the poorest nations of the earth. The British government's going to continue to increase our budget. And that's just an issue about, you make choices in politics, and I'm not criticising the Irish government, they'll make their own decision, but the British government, we're just making a clear choice, is that we have a responsibility, and we won't forget that responsibility. So while we're looking to make cuts in other parts of our budget, as we have to, we're going to try and halve the deficit over 4 years, our commitment to international development will increase. We'll continue to spend more money each year. So the way we look at it is that coming out of this recession, we don't want anyone left behind. We don't want the poorest left behind. The poorest are often first into recession and often last out of recession. That's the case in our own population, where poorest families are most affected and first affected. And the poorest nations are first affected often. And the legacy of a recession is most long-lasting. So pre-recession commitment isn't enough now. And while other countries look to make cuts in the budget, we're looking to increase our budget on the development, but also climate change. Because if we're going to get the poorest countries to change the way in which they behave, and we've got to help make it financially rewarding. And the UK government is willing to make a financial contribution to help those developing countries adjust their economies so that they protect the climate as well.
Not easy to get these views across, though, to people, as you say, the poorest people in your own area in Glasgow, people who have lost their own jobs, are struggling to get by themselves. Not easy to get these views about the importance of people in countries so far away across, is it?
Well, I think that there's been a change in Britain in the last decade. The public have really got this in a dramatic way. The biggest demonstrations in the recent decade in the UK haven't been about unemployment or some of the big social campaigns in Britain. It's been about international development. Hundreds of thousands of people millions of people signing petitions and hundreds of thousands of people going on demonstrations to support the poorest people in the world. So I think attitudes have changed in Britain on this. It's the right thing to do, is a kind of sense where most people have settled their minds. Now, of course, this attitude comes under pressure at a time of recession. We say, well, let's look after our own. Let's look after our own citizens. But I see no sign of that sentiment in Britain at the moment. There's just a real commitment, partly or largely because of people of faith and the role that churches have played, but also, to be frank, also people without faith have kind of said, look, we're a rich world and there's an inequality and we should make the world less unequal, and that means we're doing more for the world's poorest.
My thanks there to Jim Murphy, the British Government Secretary of State for Scotland. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. And don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.